Welcome to the Full FX podcast, Currency Matters, presented by me, Colin Lambert, and I regret to say, probably by my neighbour's dogs that have been barking outside the window for most of the day. Hopefully, they will be a bit quieter now. We'll get to my guest for this week in just a minute, talking IDBs and data terminals. First, I wanted to follow up on something that was published last week and attracted a lot of feedback, which was an article on the WM Fix, 4PM Fix, and the quandary of transparency versus, I guess, best execution. Now, it came after publishing a column the day before, and the feedback on both has been quite strident, I would say, is how I'd put it. Now, few disagreed with the idea that you can get improved execution through the reduced market impact by executing at a different time of day. The question really becomes, and I think the big issue that's come out of that feedback, is possibly the need for, and again, this is probably the Global Foreign Exchange Committee's purview, given that they are taking interest in what happens around the fix, but probably it's a question of like a bit more clarity over when an order goes from anticipated to firm. Because it was pointed out to me that, you know, by one correspondent that, you know, the risk sits with the bank, not the client, once the order is passed. That's 100% correct. The only thing I would say, though, is that obviously banks have cutoff times for fixed orders when they can be amended and or cancelled. And I did speak to somebody who said, like, no, we actually have a client who, you know, we have a bit of a problem with because they're quite regular cancellers of their trades in the minutes leading up to the cutoff time, which does affect your ability to A, net, and B, I guess, pre-hedge. But my correspondent was saying, yeah, look, you know, the risk sits with the banks, not the client. So therefore, the bank has a responsibility to hedge its risk with minimal slippage from the fixed rate. Now, obviously, the responsibility is an interesting one because, you know, they have a responsibility not to lose money for their shareholders as well. But the bank has that risk. Now, it was argued that this actually happens at the moment the order is transferred, not at the cutoff. I'm not convinced I agree with that one, but, you know, that's for everyone to decide themselves. The other thing was the observation by somebody, there's no pre-hedging of fixing orders. Now, this comes down to the same point. Once an order is accepted, is it hedging rather than pre-hedging? Now, what I would say is a lot of people I speak to on this subject in the banking industry regularly use the term pre-hedging, which, as I pointed out in, I think it was in my column, you know, pre-hedging as a phrase didn't exist 15 years ago. It really only came to the fore during the chat room scandal. And you wonder, was it actually somebody saying, okay, like, if we call it this, then maybe, you know, we kind of get away with what we were trying to do. Now, obviously, no one's saying there should be anything less than full disclosure and transparency around these orders. And I think most people accept that if you're trying to stick yards and yards through in a five-minute window in some currency pairs, probably in all currency pairs, there's a threshold, then you do need to sort of do something outside the window. You either wear the risk, which is frankly a bit dangerous, and you're choosing to take risks that you didn't actually, not only did you not choose to take that risk on in terms of the direction, but you did so at a rate that you have no control over. It's a lot different to saying, okay, I'll quote you a price in 3 yards and here's my spread. So we need to be careful with that one. And it struck me that the key issue around this is when the order becomes anticipated and it goes from there to firm, because then it does obviously sit with the bank. Now, the terms of the cutoff time, well, it could be argued that the cutoff time, if, for instance, a bank has a cutoff time of 3:45 p.m. London time, it could be argued that at 3:45, when that window closes for adjustments, that order then becomes firm. And I'm not sure the global code is 100% clear on this in terms of, you know, generally it still talks about anticipated orders. I think in terms of anticipated ahead of time. Now, the order doesn't really go live in terms of execution until 3:57 and a half. But I think there's a case to say that at 3:45, when you can't change it or take it back, that's a firm order. Now, then, you know, you can pre-hedge stop losses and take profits, you know, as has been pointed out, although why you'd pre-hedge or take profit, I have no idea, but you can certainly pre-hedge your stuff within reason. So I guess you could argue you can pre-hedge within reason of this firm order, but I just think the language isn't 100% clear on it. And I think that's maybe where we need to clear things up. So yes, you know, the risk is with the banks. Yes, there's hedging that probably should prudently take place, but also I think we need more clarity over exactly when is this order firm as opposed to anticipated? I think if we can solve that issue, then we can then look at the broader issues around like, well, that I think that solves any conduct issues that we might face in the future. And I think if there's one thing that most people agree on, it is that generally speaking, bank conduct is totally above board. Although in the featured, it was interesting, you know, somebody pointed out that actually, you know, there is still information leakage from the matching sessions. Because if you don't get a match, guess what? You know which way the order is going to go. Now, I think generally speaking, people have enough data then to guess which way the fix is going anyway. But it is something I know asset managers are talking about. One in particular was quite punchy with me about that. So conduct-wise, I think clearer definition in the FX Global Code would really help us. And that allows us then to go on to what I think is actually the real debate around this is this actually fit for purpose for asset managers? That is probably a podcast for another day. And you know, I think the data probably will tell us something in good time. And on the subject of data, I'm going to be back just after this quick break with this week's guest.
The Full FX newsletter carries exclusive content that doesn't appear on our website. If you want to know the latest people moves, read about some of the stranger aspects of our industry, and keep up to date on Colin Lambert's Trade of the Year, then register now at thefullfx.com. It's free and delivered to your inbox every Tuesday.
I'm joined by Kieran Harris, who's Director of Data Compliance LLC and also the publisher of the website marketdata.guru. Kieran, welcome to the podcast. There's a couple of things I'd like to sort of talk to you about this week, but something you've been studying for many years is the interdata broker space. And it's something I'm quite interested in because I look at it and think, you know, the march of technology has, I guess, threatened their business for decades and they're still going. I'd like to get a perspective from your point of view. I mean, how do you see the IDB space evolving against, you know, what is, I guess, just another challenge that they've faced over the last 20, 30 years?
Good morning, Colin. Thanks for having me here. It's a very interesting question. I find the IDBs a fascinating part of the market. They don't really fit into the traditional way of investment banking, and people don't really understand what IDBs do. They're great facilitators to make the market work by providing liquidity through pricing and pricing through technology into the market space where it doesn't otherwise exist. So the IDBs play a pretty fundamental role in a lot of the OTC markets. The only problem they've got, well, actually, it's a very major problem, is that they're faced by new entrants coming into the market, attracted by greater liquidity. And the moment you get greater liquidity, it facilitates electronic trading. And this is not something the IDBs are really good at. They've tended to be technophobic. They've been reluctant to get involved in that side of the business. They've tried, but it's never been with wholehearted effort. And if you don't put wholehearted effort in, you're not going to get a wholehearted reward. And that's precisely what's happened. So you get a situation whereby at the top of the market, the exchanges say, right, we need to diversify ourselves. We're not keen on voice broking. We want observable trading. We want technology. So they've invested pretty heavily into highly liquid electronic markets, FX in particular. You see Deutsche Börse and 360T, CBOE and Hotspot, and you got market access again in the fixed income side. And what's happened is that being electronic, they can deliver far more liquidity, far more pricing, far better price discovery, far quicker than any form of voice or hybrid can deliver. And that's forced the IDBs out of that end of the market. And it's a double whammy for these guys because not only do they lose the OTC broking, but they also lose the data sales which comes from it because they're not producing enough data to price the market. So it's a double lose. And that's forcing them into focusing on the less liquid markets. But as the less liquid markets become more liquid, it then attracts more interest from people who want to trade electronically. Mm. And the regulators like electronic trading. It's observable transactions, it's audit trails, it's records, it's documentation. And that's a problem for the IDBs. I think the IDBs right now are in a situation whereby they've got to say, where are we going in the future? What's our strategy? What's happened up until now is no longer suitable for the 2020s. And it's time for the IDBs to either adapt or die. And I think if they die, that is bad for the entire market.
So, I mean, the interesting thing, because before, I mean, if you look over the last sort of, you know, particularly last 15 years, the IDBs have typically promoted this hybrid model, haven't they? Which will be like, you know, the human broker backed up by technology. So are you thinking that maybe now in the sort of third decade of this century, that, you know, that's even the hybrid model maybe comes under threat?
Absolutely. I mean, you've already seen it in the exchange sphere, where if you take, say, Goldman Sachs in New York, they had three floors of exchange trading dealing rooms. It's now down to two. You can do far more electronically, and you don't need people. Direct market access removes that person element. And the thing about people is, sadly, they cost money. And the accountants will always look at the money over the expertise that these people will bring. And again, I think that's a sad thing, but it's an inevitable factor. Therefore, a balance needs to be found, and the IDBs have got to find it, or again, they're going to lose more markets.
Yeah. So therefore, do we sort of look at it and think that, you know, with the data, I mean, how does this affect price discovery, do you think? Because, you know, you made a very good point that, yeah, these firms do a good job in less liquid markets. You know, they are often a primary source of price discovery in these markets. Is that their protection? And it's as that's eroded that their wider business comes under threat?
Yes, I definitely think that, because the thing about electronic trading is it lends itself to analytics and models. The more data that flows into a model, the more accurate that model becomes. And when you've got, say, a highly illiquid market, you've got to rely far more on knowing about the market, having a wider range of interest and experience than you would if you're just trading electronically. So therefore, illiquid markets. And also, you've got to remember, trading on illiquid markets is far more costly, and therefore there are higher margins. The problem is you don't get as many trades. And that's where the price discovery balance between electronic trading and non-electronic trading comes in.
So what are their choices, do you think, in terms of, like, you know, you said it's like adapt or die. What sort of areas can they adapt in?
That's a difficult one.
So it's die or die then?
Yeah, I hope not. I just to give you an idea, one of the problems that they face is that they're not very well capitalized. If you take, say, BGC, right, today it's got a market cap of $1.6 billion on revenues of just under $2 billion in 2019. If you compare that to, say, CME or other on the exchange side, then they get far more higher price earnings ratios, in fact substantially higher, which means that they can employ capital to expand. And it comes down to a bit of PR. IDBs don't do PR very well. In fact, in New York, only two analysts follow BGC, so you're not going to get the coverage. And the research analysts who follow the markets, they don't know much about it. They're very familiar with exchanges. They're very familiar with regulated markets, but they're not so familiar with OTC markets. And if you're not familiar with it, you're not going to write it up. And so you've got this problem. People don't understand IDBs. The investors don't understand IDBs. And the IDBs don't help them understand them, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So effectively then, like, what you're saying is that maybe if they were a little bit more, So there's a fundamental challenge in the lack of resources to maybe properly adapt?
Well, to expand, I mean, you've got a choice. You either invent new markets, which is very, very difficult, or you've got to expand by buying competitors, which the IDBs do. But the problem with their strategy so far is they're buying up market share of people who are doing exactly the same thing as they are. And the market growth, the market value, I mean, if you take, say, market access, its revenues are $500 million, yet its market cap is towards $20 billion. And so you've got somebody like Market Access, which has got a quarter of the revenues of BGC, but 10 times the market value. And Market Access does everything electronically. So the challenge is to adapt to the less liquid markets, produce new products, services which relate to more structured products, far more longer-term investment, which, given that IDBs are transaction-oriented and they've got a kind of fixation towards transactions and then the next transaction, they're not very strategic in approach. And the other alternative is to buy into the electronic trading mantra. And I think TPI Cap and their purchase of LiquidNet, which was highly opportunistic, is a good case in point of what they need to do, because they're not going to develop internally. They don't have the money. They don't have the expertise. So you've got to buy it in. And then again, that comes down to the problem of how much capital and cash have you got.
I guess there's also the challenge of making sure of identifying the right platform to buy into, because, yeah, I mean, for instance, ICAP bought EBS all those years ago and did very, very well out of it, has to be said. Yeah, I mean, under its tutelage, you know, volumes on EBS went up by four times. But it equally, since then, they've declined by a serious amount as well. So you need to make sure that the platform that you're buying is in a market that's going to be in a growth phase and probably limited competition. Is that fair?
Well, funny enough, I think the competition aspect is not so important, because it helps. The more liquidity you've got, it's easier to grow the cake than it is to compete for a smaller pie or a share of the same size pie. And I think where you've got EBS, I think, is a very good case in point. eSpeed, which was sold off to NASDAQ. These were the IDBs, classic. They didn't invest in the technologies. So when EBS got sold off and ended up at CME and eSpeed at NASDAQ, the IDBs had not invested in the... I mean, they're still using 1990s tech, basically. And that is heavy in infrastructure. It costs more. Whereas the new people like Market Access, LiquidNet, they've got lightweight tech, easy deployable. They can expand the market by making it easier for people to connect. It's all about that access side of it. EBS and eSpeed are not easy to connect to, whereas the new lightweight techs using cloud, using more flexible technology, makes it easier to connect. And again, you get far more people being able to come in and participate in the market.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think, you know, they're trying to invest at what could be a very difficult time, because, you know, there is an argument out there that suggests that, you know, the existing technology infrastructure of markets is actually going to change radically over the next 5 years. And a lot of the incumbents may not even be in place in 5 years' time, because they'll be overtaken by this new lighter tech, more nimble tech that you're talking about. So in a way, that could be positive for the IDBs, because if they can identify the right firm, it will probably be cheaper to buy them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you see what ICE has been doing, it's exactly that. Trying to buy people in and then develop new technology, it's costly. It takes time. It's far cheaper to go out and say to small startups who want some funding and say, hey, come in. We will do the funding. We will do that. And the IDBs are really perfectly placed to do this, because there's still a lot of markets which haven't been taken advantage of, even if they are relatively illiquid. So the IDBs could do that, but that would I mean, again, this comes down to the problem. The IDBs are at this point in time where they need new strategies for the 2020s, and they need a new mindset. They can't carry on going as they have been. It needs a new way of looking at how they're going to exploit the markets where they've currently got an advantage in, or else somebody will do it for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because what they do have going for them, and I would imagine would be particularly helpful for new tech, is intellectual capital and how markets work.
Yeah, I mean, again, it comes back to this people against technology. Tech can do an awful lot for you in terms of efficiency, but tech doesn't have knowledge. I've been down on the dealing room floors of all the IDBs, and there's some seriously clever people there. They can do calculations in their head. They can spot trends. They know the people. Computers don't know people. Those people on the desk, they do know people. They know how they're going to react. They know how they're going to think. And they can spot a model, or an analytical model can spot a trend through process, whereas somebody can sit there and say, ah, point A, we're here, but there's point D, and I think we're going to get to point D without going through point B and C. People think laterally, and the IDBs, the people on the desks of the IDBs are bright people, and they can do that.
So it's not all bad news, but a critical tipping point may be approaching, I guess, is the way I'd summarize that.
Oh, I think that we're right at that tipping point. Post-COVID, the world's going to change. Everybody says that. And who am I to argue? But at the same time, the TPI caps, the BGCs of the world, they've got this opportunity to adapt now. I mean, in fact, in some ways, the COVID problem right now has given them the time to be able to say, "Hey, let's think about it," which wouldn't have existed if it hadn't happened. Again, when you're locked into a particular mindset, are you able to change that mindset? A lot of people aren't, and IDBs are quite traditional.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I guess then it comes down to their ultimate choice. As you said very earlier, it's adapt or die. And I think people facing extinction do tend to sort of suddenly open their minds. Kieran, while I've got you on, actually, I wanted to raise something else with you because...
Sure.
Now, regular listeners to my podcast will know that there's a lot that I don't know. But you actually published something last week that I didn't know or I hadn't really thought of. And that is, you were looking at terminals, which is obviously a big business in this world. And pretty much your headline was, you think Bloomberg's the biggest terminals? Well, actually, no, they're not. It's the biggest terminal business out there. What were your findings there? Can you share the top level findings with us?
Oh, okay. I mean, here it's all about Bloomberg having been considered the number one market data vendor since 2000, and definitely as a gold standard, they definitely are the vendor which all the others look up to and imitate. I mean, if you go to China, for instance, and go and see the local data vendors, they use the Bloomberg color system. The offices are done out like Bloomberg, and they all say, "Hey, we're China's Bloomberg." And then in 2011, they finally overtook Refinitiv, which was then Thomson Reuters, in terms of revenue. And for the entire 2010s, they're the undisputed king of market data. Interesting, late last year, IHS is being bought by S&P Global.
Yep.
The IHS market shareholders last week approved the merger, and the combined entity by revenues is now going to be larger than Bloomberg by about 5%. I mean, you're talking about 11.7 billion to 11 billion. And when you look at the two types of businesses, both are in market data, but both are very different entities. Bloomberg's very heavily into the terminal business. That's their core. They're growing their terminal business in a market which is shrinking. And in fact, we just alluded to that in that you've got DMA, which precludes people on the desk. And if you don't have people on the desk, they don't need terminals. But again, what you do need is analytics. And this is where S&P comes in. they're very IP driven indices, credit ratings, analytics, and I don't know if you're aware, but the S&P market cap is 85 billion right now on revenues of 5 billion, and that's due to IP ownership. You don't need to have terminals on the desk. You need to be providing the information. You need to own that information, which S&P does. It's got to have a brand, which S&P does, and it's got to be something which is not easily to replicate. And yes, you can try and copy the S&P 500, but you can never be the S&P 500. And it's that ownership of proprietary information and data which is going to drive the market and market liquidity as well through the 2020s. You're going to see less reliance upon terminals and far more reliance upon data, IP-driven indices, benchmarks, and very importantly, analytics for the 2020s. It's from a data perspective, it's going to be very, very interesting. And if you're an investor, it's going to change the way you think and approach the markets, because data is going to drive how you relate to the market.
It's fascinating stuff. And it just reinforces in my mind how we're on the cusp of what could be, you know, looking back in 10 years' time, quite a historic change in the markets.
Oh, I think it's going to change the way people interact. There's going to be a lot of disintermediation. There's going to be a lot of new players coming into the market. And I think one of the key things is that people think in linear terms. In 2020s, we're going to have to forget that linear aspect, and we're going to have to think in a multidimensional aspect of how you connect, how you access, how you trade, and how you use data to trade. So it's all interrelated, but the pathways are not straight. They're in multiple ways.
Yeah. Kieran, thanks very much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thanks.
And a lot of food for thought there, some of which we may revisit again. So thanks for your time. To our listeners, thanks very much for downloading the podcast from the website, or hopefully this week from the Apple Store. We'll see if it works this week. And we'll be back again soon. So thank you very much.